Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman. Welcome to another edition of the ESI Bytes show, where we attempt to provide information on different areas of electronic discovery from the perspective of a variety of national speakers at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and at a time when everyone has time to listen to a show, which is at the listener's discretion. And today I'm thrilled we've got a fellow Pittsburgher, David Rees, on the line. He's going to talk about some of the critical role of preservation in an electronic discovery case. David is a partner at the law firm of Thorpe Reed & Armstrong. He's had an extensive background working in computers. He chairs the firm's technology committee and e-discovery and records management group. He's got more than 30 years of experience in those areas. And he lectures and writes extensively for the American Bar Association and PBI, Pennsylvania Bar Institute, on electronic discovery. David, thanks for joining us on the show.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Okay, so before we jump into preservation, I always like to ask how each of the speakers, how they get involved in the world of electronic discovery.
Well, as you mentioned with my bio, I've worked with technology since the early 1980s. I actually got my first PC in 1982, and I've worked with both legal technology and technology issues for clients since then. So e-discovery was kind of a natural area for me to get into. I first got involved in it a little over 10 years ago in the late 1990s.
Okay. Well, let's jump right into the topic here. Let's talk a little bit about preservation, the critical role it plays in e-discovery, and what are your obligations generally for preservation?
Well, generally the obligation is to preserve electronically stored information for both litigation and investigations. And this is an odd duty of the duty to preserve, or an outgrowth of the duty to preserve evidence generally, that's been around for a long time for paper and physical evidence, and now it's evolved into electronic data. You know, it's not defined in the new federal e-discovery rules. It's defined in case law that dates back years before e-discovery, and recent cases have extended this long-lasting duty of preservation into the electronic data area.
And when does, this is one of the top questions everyone talks about, is, you know, everyone knows how much work can get involved once you've got to start. But when is the trigger get pulled requiring you to start to preserve? Do we know when it is? Is it an ephemeral feeling you get in your gut? I mean, what is it?
Well, sometimes it's at both ends of the spectrum. Sometimes it's very clear. Other times it's difficult to determine exactly when the duty arises. The black letter rules are kind of clear. You know, first of all, if there is litigation or there is an investigation, you have to preserve it. And I mean, that's the no-brainer. But the difficult area, it's clear in black letter law, but not application. That is when a party reasonably anticipates litigation or an investigation. And just as an example, it's a case you and I have discussed in programs before. The Land of Lakes case is a 2007 IP case. And in that case, the judge actually very carefully parsed the language of demand letters from some pretty conciliatory ones to ones that threatened litigation, and decided that the duty there didn't evolve or wasn't triggered until the letters actually discussed litigation. So, you know, it can be an event, it can be notice that someone's going to sue you, it can be a lot of different things. So if there is litigation or investigation, it's clear. The other end, when you reasonably anticipate litigation, it can be very, very difficult.
So when that duty is triggered, you know, if you've decided it's been triggered or clearly you've been sued, how do you decide what must be preserved?
Well, that depends very much on, you know, the type of case it is and what kind of electronic information the client has. At the one end, again, we have something pretty clear. If you're already in litigation and something has been requested by the other party, or if you receive a subpoena for information, then you have to preserve that. But at the other end, again, there's an unclear area. It's electronically stored information that's relevant or may be relevant to the litigation. So you need to look at things like, what are the issues in the case? Who are the key players? You certainly don't have to save everything, but you have to make a reasonable, good faith effort to decide what is relevant and make an effort to preserve it. And it's important to point out that the duty to preserve is almost always broader than the duty to actually produce. So when you're starting out early, you have to take a broader sweep in most cases and decide what you have to keep. If there's any doubt, unless it gets to the point of being ridiculous, you generally want to keep it rather than discard it.
Now let's talk about what happens if you don't preserve. Let's say you make a mistake. You don't turn off the auto-delete function of your email or something like that. What are the ramifications?
Well, it can be a range of things. And, of course, everyone talks about sanctions, but I like to start at the other end when I warn people about it. And that is, you may be losing evidence that's important for you to prove your case or your client's case. So, all information that's lost or destroyed isn't harmful. You always expect the worst of your adversary. But again, the number one risk to me is that you may lose something that you need to prove your case. And then at the other end, there's the whole range of sanctions that courts impose when something, has been lost. And we'll talk later about what the range of sanctions can be, but it can be anything from, just a small civil penalty to a default judgment or even criminal prosecution.
Now let's look at the other end, sort of the Land O'Lakes issue. If you're seeking preservation from the other side, what steps should you take to put the other side on notice?
That again depends a lot on the particular case and who your adversary is. In some of the early stages of discovery, it was becoming fairly routine to send a preservation letter to the other side. That's becoming a lot less common now. Some people are still doing it, but in that situation, you send a letter to opposing counsel or to the opposing party if they don't yet have counsel, and you say, we are going to initiate litigation, or we have initiated litigation. Here's what's relevant to it, and we insist that you preserve it. Beyond that step, if you don't send the demand letter or the preservation letter to the other side, then in the federal system, preservation comes up during the meet and confer. That's one of the things that the parties are supposed to discuss and try to agree on. It also comes up in the initial court scheduling order, often after a conference, where preservation issues are one of the things that the court should address.
Yeah, I should mention that I'm going to be doing a podcast with Arianna Tadler from Milberg, one of the leading plaintiff class action firms in the country, and she's going to be focusing extensively on how to go through that dialogue through the meet and confer to make sure you're getting what you want instead of too much or too little.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very critical stage in the e-discovery process, particularly to make it work and to make it cost-effective, and, where people just kind of blow it off and check it off as a requirement by the court rather than something they need to do, they can lose a lot for their client.
Actually, Dave, the reason we're doing this podcast was I was talking to a good friend of mine in town who's had a couple of e-discovery cases, and he was frustrated realizing a couple of years into litigation that he hadn't effectively preserved evidence. And he said this is a mistake that a lot of novices will make and learn, unfortunately, the hard way.
Even some people who are fairly experienced that haven't been through cases with the same kinds of preservation issues can get bit.
So what happens if you aren't specific enough on what you're trying to get?
Well, if you're not specific enough in what you want the other side to preserve, then when it gets to the time for production, it may be gone. So being specific at the preservation step, that's kind of step one. As far as your own client, if you don't give specific information or instructions to your client, there can be a misunderstanding, and something that you are assuming they are keeping can be lost.
We're actually, I'm doing a podcast in a couple of weeks on what happens when a judge lets you down, and the scenario of not being specific enough and putting a defendant with a lot of data in an awkward position of having to preserve and then possibly produce way too much can put a lot of cost on a defendant. And
But in that case, a party, whether it be a plaintiff or defendant, who has received a preservation notice from the other side, should bring it to the court's attention, because it's one thing to start preserving today, but it can kind of skyrocket and keep going forward as more and more has to be preserved, particularly in cases that are dealing with current information rather than historic information. So if the other side demands that you preserve too much, the best thing, if they will hear you, is to get before the judge and get a determination.
Well, we all know we don't live in a perfect world. So what typically happens when parties make mistakes in this area?
Well, judges, I don't think, expect attorneys to be perfect in e-discovery, because few people, no matter how experienced they are perfect. But what can happen is that you can, face sanctions through mistakes. And I kind of look at it as a continuum of the type of conduct. It can start on the one side with an honest mistake. At the other end, it's a deliberate decision to not produce or to destroy something. And the more you move from the honest mistake to the deliberate conduct, the sanctions can get worse. There is some risk at the honest mistake end. If you make a perfectly innocent and honest mistake and destroy evidence that's critical to the other side, you or your client still may face sanctions. But the worse the conduct gets, the greater the risk is of sanctions, and the more harsh the sanctions are likely to be. And from attending a number of classes that judges have taught, teaching some classes with judges, and just talking to judges, they're not looking for perfection, and they understand that there will be mistakes. But what they're looking for is a good faith, reasonable process carried out by people who understand the technical and legal issues, and sometimes that takes a team. Often it takes a team. They want it to be documented, and certainly they want candor. And the more you go toward those goals, the less likely there are to be serious consequences from a mistake. And also, Rule 37 in the federal e-discovery amendments gives you some limited protection, a limited safe harbor. It basically says that generally sanctions should not be imposed under Rule 37 for information that's lost in the routine good faith operation of an information system. It's only limited protection because there's some qualifying language in it. Also, courts have said you still have to act promptly to preserve. You can't sit back and let emails be automatically deleted or backup tapes be automatically overwritten and not take affirmative action to preserve them. But there at least is a little bit of protection from mistakes or routine operations there.
Now, we sort of alluded to this topic when I mentioned the upcoming podcast with Arianna Tadler, but it seems like early on the requester really doesn't know what they're going to get. And the preserver can be overwhelmed with having to preserve lots of information because they don't know what's potentially responsive either. Is there a way to do this smarter by working together?
I think there's a way to do virtually every aspect of e-discovery by working together. And I think it's far better if you can agree on preservation. What are the issues? Who are the key players? Is there a relevant time frame that you can restrict the information you're preserving until then? Is metadata going to be relevant? Are backup tapes going to be relevant? A lot of times you don't know that up front, but the more you can communicate and deal with things on an ongoing basis, you might start with broader preservation and then move on and start narrowing it and limit what has to be retained as time goes on. But I'm sure you're familiar with the new Sedona Cooperation Proclamation that came out last summer and has been endorsed by a number of federal and state judges, and it basically says for e-discovery to work, you have to cooperate. E-discovery shouldn't be a second battlefront in the litigation. E-discovery should go along with the litigation and serve its purpose.
And you know, it's interesting. I did a really neat podcast with Richard Brayman, who's the executive director of the Sedona Conference, specifically on the cooperation proclamation. And it's interesting, but there are other areas of law which have followed this path. And one of them is, as a lawyer, one of the areas I encountered when I practiced was family law. And there's a big collaboration effort in family law, collaborative law. And it seems like sometimes lawyers recognize when the process doesn't work very well, and you got to collaborate, or both sides are going to grind themselves into, really high costs. I think this is a good example.
Yeah, and for cooperation to work in e-discovery, both parties or all parties have to do it. I mean, I actually think that a party can be hurt by trying too hard to cooperate if the other or other parties won't. But if all parties will cooperate on the things they should cooperate on, it really can save cost and make it more effective. And I mean, just an example, you may not be able to agree whether backup tapes need to be preserved or not, but at least be willing to cooperate on how many backup tapes there are, trying to get an idea of how difficult it is to access information on them. You may have to go to court and, have a judge decide whether you have to keep them or not. So, we're not giving up our advocacy for our clients by cooperating, but, decide where the battle should be and, where the cooperation and agreement should be.
Okay, and last question is, what does a litigation hold?
Well, pretty simply, that's the process of preserving paper and electronic evidence for litigation or an investigation. The first place I saw that term used was in Judge Shindlin's Zubilek case. I don't think it was used in a case before that, but again, that's the process of how you do this, and I think that would be a good topic for another podcast.
And actually, on May 5th, John Jablonski from Goldberg and Segala is going to talk about this, and he's written a book on legal holds for ARMA, and he has a blog titled Legal Holds. So it is a good topic, and glad we're going to be covering this. Go ahead.
I look forward to hearing that one because it's an area that is one of the most difficult of e-discovery to implement, particularly for a client that's doing it for the first time.
Well, David, I really appreciate you sharing some of your thoughts on this area. Appreciate, always enjoy doing programs with you. And you've been listening to another edition of ESI Bytes. And, you should learn bite-sized pieces of electronically stored information or e-discovery before e-discovery bites you is basically the way we look at it. I sort of garbled that one, but you know what I mean. And, we'll look forward to having you on more shows, David. So if any listeners want to listen to other shows, we've got a complete catalog of shows at www.esibytes.com. And again, my name is Carl Shineman. I'm with Jurinov, and you've listened to another edition of ESI Bytes. Thanks a lot.